Jan Leszewski playing an encore live here at the Royal Albert Hall to round off his Proms debut. A Chopin Nocturne in C-sharp minor, opus 27, number 1. He held this audience in the palm of his hand, and he's so composed on stage, so still. He really takes his time. A beautiful, beautiful player, just 18 years old. And as I said, somehow very grounded. He said he still makes time, even in a busy concert schedule, to do normal things, to be a normal teenager, to have fun. He's off to Verbier for a few days now, for the music festival there, and a bit of relaxation. Well, in the second half of tonight's concert, we'll be hearing Rachmaninoff's Second Symphony, the orchestra of the Academy of Santa Cecilia turning to Russia. And we're now going to find out about that piece of music in an event which took place over the road in the Royal College of Music earlier on this afternoon, hosted by Louise Fryer.
Hello. My guests are William Myvill, head of composition here at the Royal College of Music and a composer himself, and Gerald Seaman, who teaches at Oxford University and who's an authority on Russian music. And they're with me to discuss Rachmaninoff and his Second Symphony that rounds off tonight's Prom. Written a decade before the revolution in 1907, William, what's the symphony about?
It's a huge romantic symphony on, you know, possibly the largest scale. It's an abstract symphony. And I think really that it's about three main kinds of music. One of the most striking aspects of this piece, you know, when you hear the beginning of it, is that it's a music of complete despair. And as the music develops, we also get these wonderful big tunes that you associate with Rachmaninoff. There's, you know, these big lyrical moments. But you also have this music of enormous violence that builds and erupts as the music actually develops. I mean, perhaps that's a kind of simplification of what it's about, because I think what Rachmaninoff manages to set up is a kind of confrontation between something very bleak and something very negative and something very, very positive, if you like, the very bleak opening and the very positive sort of big tunes that carry the music on. And I think it's quite extraordinary the level of intensity with which these two very different ideas collide. And I think that's what drives the sort of nature of the music, really.
Well, let's listen to the very opening of the symphony. I think even on this very hot day, it transports us to a very, very cold place, doesn't it?
It's the kind of music that makes you not want to get out of bed in the morning, really, isn't it? Everything about it suggests a failure of purpose. The melodies, as they develop, move in very strange, unexpected directions and then stop. These chords that come in the wind are just placed there, and again, then they stop. Everything is about something going nowhere. The strings are right in the bottom of their lowest possible registers, which is just about the most unpleasant place where you can write for strings, if you like. And, you know, it feels to me incredibly bleak, incredibly purposeless, and empty of energy. But then, of course, it carries on and the music develops very, very positively. You know, something grows out of this music. It gradually seems to come together.
Now, Gerald, Rachmaninoff was famously described as 6'3" of Russian gloom. Is this kind of bleak outlook unique to him, or is it something that's characteristic of the Russian soul?
No, I think it's the Russians. Russian culture is full of fatalism. And I think that one of the great keys to Russian music is Russian literature. Now, Rachmaninoff himself was passionately devoted to Russian literature, his favourite authors being Pushkin, Lermontov and Chekhov. Now, Pushkin, of course, every Russian knows, had a very tragic end. He was actually killed in a trumped-up duel when he was only 38 years of age, and his life was really cut tragically short. Lermontov was even younger. He was also killed in a trumped-up duel, and he was only 27. And so it's not surprising, really, that Rachmaninoff should have been very much influenced, as all Russian cultured people were, by these events. And so one of the favourite works of Rachmaninoff was Pushkin's The Gypsies, which he actually used for his own opera, Aliakho. Now, it's very interesting to compare the character of Aliakho and Yevgeny Onegin, because both are outcasts. They don't fit into the contemporary society. And so I'm sure there's no doubt that Rachmaninoff, bearing in mind the tremendous amount of criticism he had, people called him an epigon, the fact he was writing in a conservative musical style, which is what he wanted, and not pursuing atonality and Schoenberg and Weber and everything else. And so this meant that he was filled always with self-doubts. And this is one of the tragedies, really. So it's very interesting from this point of view, that Rachmaninoff should be have this element of self-doubt which pursues all his music the whole time.
And then, William, where do we go? Where do those roots of hope spring from?
Well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, if this music is about anything, it's about self-doubt. It's about the fact, you know, can anything come out of this? But what happens to this music is this enormous surprise as he takes these tiny fragments, almost of icicles, and then somehow manages to thaw them into something flowing, into something melodic. And, you know, that is a wonderful moment to me when that starts to happen. And I think we can hear a little section now as what was something very negative and nihilistic suddenly starts to blossom into something much more lyrical.
So is this the flip side, do you think, of the Russian character, that if they can experience the depths of emotion, they can experience the heights too, Gerald?
Yes, it's very true that Russian music is full of the contrast.
This piece, I think, is interesting in that here what triumphs is the positive, I think, all the time. And I think the tension between the negative and the positive is what actually drives this piece. What happens as the music develops is that there are these enormous tensions between the positive and the negative. Mm. And that breaks out, I think, this huge first movement develops into something really very dramatic and very exciting. And I think we can hear a little bit from that now.
it's edge of the seat stuff, isn't it? You can't just kind of sit and let it waft over you. It forces you to listen.
Well, this is absolutely it. I mean, it's attention-seeking, it's assertive, and it's defiant, really, in the face of failure. And this is, you know, something that was very real for Rachmaninoff. But there's also something else. I mean, if one is looking at it from a purely musical point of view, as Gerald said, you know, Rachmaninoff was a deeply conservative figure, and he stood for what one might call conservative values. And some of those conservative values included sonata form, sonata structure, and the ideas of musical development, setting up a sequence of opposites and then trying to fight a way between them. And this is exactly what he does in this music.
Now, you mentioned the personal aspect. He had had a disaster, hadn't he, with his first symphony, so failure was something he was very familiar with.
Yes, of course. I don't think the complete story has ever been told, really, about why that first symphony failed. I mean, it's generally recognised that Glazunov was intoxicated at the time, which is hardly a good recommendation for
him. He was conducting it, wasn't he? Which wasn't great.
But the thing was that Cui was really not a very nice person at all. He was, if you actually read Cui's letters and his writings, as I have done, then he's a really nasty piece of work. And I think that, you know, usually you think of the Magucha Kuchka, the mighty handful, as being a happy gathering of people. But it was nothing like that at all. Poor Musos had a terrible time, and they're always kind of tearing him to pieces, this kind of thing. And the other thing, of course, was the rivalry between St. Petersburg and Moscow. That it was a very close-knit community, as it were. And so Rachmaninoff, of course, came from the other place, from Moscow. And therefore, this was another of the reasons that people were kind of not well disposed towards him from the very beginning. So all these things taken together tend to put the whole thing in a slightly different light.
And what did he do? I mean, he fled almost, didn't he?
Well, he didn't write anything for 3 years. And, of course, he did actually have some treatment of hypnosis, which is said to have helped immensely. But the main thing was that he didn't give up. He actually came back again.
And, he destroyed the first symphony, though, didn't he? Or he attempted to.
Attempted to, yes. The Russians are always doing that. They're always
throwing their symphonies on the fire.
He's a perfectionist, that's the trouble. And that's the reason, really, there are relatively few recordings of Rachmaninoff's performance, because being a perfectionist, when he actually listened to his playing, if he found there's the slightest error, then he wouldn't accept it. And so it makes life very difficult, doesn't it?
Do you think, William, there's something about his vulnerability and the vulnerability in the music that makes it instantly something we can connect with?
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. This is a man who was able, in a virtuosic way, to transfer his feelings, to transfer his emotions into his music. And I think perhaps one of the best examples of that is the heart of this symphony for me, which is the third movement, which is the third slow movement, which is, although it's deeply lyrical, although it's deeply passionate, it is one of the most subtle pieces of emotionalism music that I think I know. I mean, every moment shades emotional feeling in a slightly different way. You know, almost every cadence takes you into a slightly different world. It's very subtly slightly different world. You know, some composers are enormously crude with their emotionalism. Rachmaninoff, for all his conservatism, is immensely sophisticated, and I think this is why he speaks to us today as such an important composer, in whatever one might think about his conservatism or his popularity, but nonetheless he is popular. And I think, you know, if we listen to the opening of this third movement, which is the slow movement, we can hear this immense subtlety, and it's followed by this enormously passionate clarinet solo. One of the best things ever written for the clarinet, I think, possibly. and it's such a pity to stop it. I want to carry on listening to it. I mean, what's amazing to me here is the way in which he keeps delaying any sense of closure. You keep thinking a musical phrase is about to come to an end, but then incredibly gently it moves off in a very different direction. It's something so serene and yet at the same time filled with an immense range of feeling and emotion. I mean, the shading of every moment in this movement is quite remarkable.
Often one doesn't connect Rachmaninoff very much with Russian folk music. And it is true that Rachmaninoff only uses real folk songs on one or two occasions, like in the three Russian songs. But an important factor in Rachmaninoff, as in most Russian composers, you will laugh at this, but it's actually the effect of the peasant nurse. And so all well-to-do Russian families in the 19th century would entrust their children to a peasant nurse. And this was a case of Pushkin, Glinka, Rachmaninoff, Tchaikovsky, you name it. And so these peasant nurses will be responsible for actually keeping the children quiet from a very, very early age. And the way in which they did that was to actually sing Russian folk songs to them and, of course, tell them stories of the quite horrific stories, actually, of Russian folklore. And so the great thing about Russian folk music is that it's extraordinarily lyrical. Some of the melodies in the Russian folk songs are absolutely superb, unsurpassed, I might say. And it is a gigantic culture as well, like the country itself. Well, Rachmaninoff was influenced in particular, I think, by one particular folk song genre, which is called the Russian protyazhnaya pyesnya, the Russian drawling song. Now, this is a song of very, very great length. It's a lyrical song, but usually associated with very deep emotion. And somehow, to take up your point, it seems to go on, and every time you think it's going to end, it goes on into another facet. But the interesting thing is that every time you have a different verse, then the music is subtly varied. And, of course, isn't this what Rachmaninoff does all the time? And Stravinsky, too, for that matter. That you have this kind of subtle variation. And I think this actually comes from folk music. So, in other words, folk music in Rachmaninoff, it's a kind of distillation, not an imitation. Yeah. When you listen this evening, in about three-quarters of the way through the slow movement, the music dies down. And all you hear is a clarinet solo. And the clarinet solo, it's not generally recognized, but that the tune that is being played there is actually identical with the music played by a Russian peasant shepherd's pipe, the sviriel. And so in the midst of all this activity, you can just imagine Rachmaninoff suddenly start to think of the steppes and the wild, the rough, the way in which the corn and the rye went into the distance. And he's filled with nostalgia for a moment, and then pulls itself together and gets back again. But do look out for that moment, because it is quite unique, and I'm sure it's not there accidentally.
But then he does something quite different with the finale, so we're back to conflict in a way.
We are. He starts off with a kind of tarantella, which is an Italian dance almost. I mean, I think the heart of the symphony is in the first movement and in the slow movement. The two scherzo movements, which are the second movement, which we haven't had time to talk about really, and then the last movement, which starts off as a scherzo, develops into something else, of course, but it starts off as a tarantella. It's an Italian dance, you know, exactly that kind of folky dance they get. It's very ebullient and very extrovert, and I think we can hear a little bit of it.
So lots of energy returning after we've been able to express our feelings, I suppose. This is very much a sense of resurgence, of excitement.
These two movements, both the scherzo and the finale, are dance movements in effect. And they're sort of releases of energy, which lead again to the explosion of the big tune as the last movement develops. And, you know, it's part of the enormous complexity of the symphony. I mean, Rachmaninoff was able to encompass this huge range of world, really, not just an emotional world, but also a musical world as well. And it's interesting, of course, that when he wrote this piece, he wasn't in Russia at all. He was in Dresden, in Germany.
Gerald, how did Rachmaninoff talk about his own music?
Rachmaninoff actually wrote himself, "I try to make my music speak simply and directly that which is in my heart at the time I'm composing. If there is love there, or bitterness, or sadness, or religion, these moods become part of my music, and it becomes either beautiful, or bitter, or sad, or religious. I am a Russian composer. My music is the product of my temperament, and so it is Russian music. Music must come from the heart, and go to the heart."
And I hope you'll have your hearts open this evening. Thank you very much, Gerald Seaman and William Meibel.
Gerald Seaman, William Meibel, and Louise Fryer, BBC Radio 3, in conversation earlier on this afternoon across the road from the Royal Albert Hall at the Royal College of Music in today's Proms Plus event. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall. I'm Sarah Moore-Peach. We are live for the first of two prom concerts tonight. The second one is a late night prom. It starts at 10:15. Two works by Stockhausen in the programme. His epic electronic work, Gesang der Jünglinge, a seminal work, and sound projection is done by Katinka Passfir. And we're also hearing Ex Cathedra singing an extract from Mittwoch aus Licht, which had its world premiere last year as part of the 2012 celebrations in Birmingham. So that's to look forward to later on, and Louise Fryer will be back for that. But now we're back with the orchestra of the Academy of Santa Cecilia from Rome for the second half of their prom, the first that they're giving out of two. The next one tomorrow is called Viva Verdi, but for now, of course, they're off to Russia for music by Rachmaninoff, his second symphony. Antonio.
Interestingly enough, the Russian language and the Italian language are both horizontal languages. What I mean by that is that the rhythm of the language tends to go forward, tends to not have big vertical stops like in the German language. So an Italian will have an innate sense of how to shape these melodies. This piece was written mainly in Dresden. Rachmaninoff was going to the opera all the time, the Semper Opera, and heard a lot of Wagner. Very interesting. If you've conducted Tristan and if you conducted Meistersinger, which I have on many occasions, you see what he gleaned from all that. There's chromatic passages, the sensual, yearning feeling, and also, but sparkling, rhythmic work in the writing that is no question influenced by that. So opera and this symphony are not too far away from each other. Of course, in the slow movement, you have one of the great melodies, and it repeats and it repeats and it repeats, and you somehow can't get enough of it. And my orchestra certainly can't get enough of it. They love playing it.
Sir Antonio Papano talking about his orchestra, the Orchestra of the Academy of Santa Cecilia in Rome, which is an august and ancient institution dating back to the 16th century. The orchestra itself formed at the very beginning of the 20th century, and Antonio Papano has been its music director since 2005. He was telling me earlier that he's managed to appoint several new players and bring the average age of the orchestra down quite a lot and increase their touring schedule as well. And they're in London for 2 days. They're giving another concert, as I mentioned earlier, tomorrow at the Proms of Verdi. But now it's to Rachmaninoff, his second symphony. Antonio Papano making his way on stage to conduct his orchestra from Rome.
Thank you.
Rachmaninoff's Second Symphony, performed live at the BBC Proms in the Royal Albert Hall by Sir Antonio Pappano and his orchestra from Rome, the orchestra of the Academy of Santa Cecilia, named after the patron saint of music. Music must come from the heart and go to the heart, said Rachmaninoff, as we heard earlier on this evening. They played with heart and he conducted with heart, and he looks like he's just run a marathon, but he's got a big grin on his face. Antonio Pappano coming back on stage, motioning first of all to the principal clarinet, Alessandro Carbonari. That glorious moment at the opening of the third movement. Principal oboist Francesco Di Rosa. Principal flute Andrea Oliva. Quite a few of the members of the orchestra Pappano himself has appointed since he took over as their music director in 2005. Like I said earlier on, he and they wear their history very lightly. It's an august institution that the orchestra is part of. And since it formed in 1908, it's been conducted by the likes of Richard Strauss, Sibelius, Stravinsky, Toscanini, Foote, Wengler, Carian, Cellini and Kleiber. And of course, Antonio Pappano, who's making his way back on stage now. Motioning to tonight's leader, Carlo Maria Parazzoli. Just put his hand on his heart and gestured to the audience, and now he's going to give us an encore. Ponchielli to end the first part of our evening here at the Royal Albert Hall at the Proms. Antonio Pappano and the orchestra of the Academy of Santa Cecilia from Rome. The first of two proms they're giving during this season. The next one is tomorrow night. It's called Viva Verdi, which says it all. And meanwhile, tonight, the Albert Hall is going to clear and refill in the space of just over an hour. We're back here at 10:15 for a double bill of Stockhausen, Gesang der Jünglinge and the World Parliament sequence from his Mittwoch aus Licht. Late night Stockhausen still to come. But between now and then, I'll hand you on to Broadcasting House and John Shea.
Thank you very much to Sarah Moore-Peach, presiding over the first of tonight's proms. You can hear it again next Tuesday afternoon here on BBC Radio 3, or, of course, any time you like online for the next 7 days via the Radio 3 website. And if you'd like to watch it, well, our colleagues at BBC 4 have been recording it tonight, and you can see it over on BBC 4 next Thursday evening, beginning at 7:30. Well, the proms aren't just about orchestral music or indeed the Royal Albert Hall.
Over the course of the prom season, from now until the 2nd of September, every Monday lunchtime, Radio 3 heads to London's Cadogan Hall for chamber music of all shapes and sizes. A stellar cast of musicians includes pianist Imogen Cooper, tenor Ian Bostridge, and trumpeter Tina Ting-Helset, along with the UK premiere of Sir Harrison Birtwistle's The Moth Requiem. Chamber music at the BBC Proms. Live Monday lunchtimes at 1 o'clock on BBC Radio 3, or catch up with the first concert featuring violinist Wilde Frang by going online to the Radio 3 website.
Well, next tonight on Radio 3, in just under 30 minutes, we explore the invention, fantasy and flights of the imagination taken by the Italian writer Italo Calvino. Suspended in Air is on the air at 9:30. And then after that, we'll be back at the Royal Albert Hall, as Sarah Moore-Peach just told us, for our late-night Stockhausen prom, and that's at 10:15. So before all that, more Russian music from a composer of the generation before Rachmaninoff. Rimsky-Korsakov composed his Capriccio Espagnol in 1887, and it's one of the most colourful orchestral works by this most colourful of orchestrators. But I'm afraid you'll have to imagine all that for now. This is Rimsky's own arrangement of it for piano duo. Arthur Pizarro and Vita Panomariovita are the pianists here.
Thank you.
That was Rimsky-Korsakov's own two-piano arrangement, or arrangement for piano duo, I should say, of his Capriccio Espagnol. Arto Pizzaro and Vita Pano Mariovaita were the pianists there. And while we're speaking of Russian music, I should draw your attention to tomorrow afternoon's music feature, tomorrow lunchtime here on BBC Radio 3. Bridget Kendall, the BBC's former Moscow correspondent, tells the story of Stravinsky's visit to Moscow and his home city of Leningrad, as St. Petersburg was then called, in 1962. The exile returned. That's tomorrow lunchtime here on Radio 3 at 12:15. Well, before tonight's feature at 9:30, and after that orchestral showpiece without an orchestra, how about some opera without any singers? Well, with the clarinet solo from Rachmaninoff's Second Symphony still echoing around, here's something for clarinet and orchestra. Variations by Franz Danzi on La Ci Darem La Mano, Don Giovanni and Zerlina's duet from Act One of Mozart's opera. Sabina Meyer is the clarinetist here. Franz Welser-Most conducts the Zurich Opera Orchestra. Franz Danzi's Variations on La Ci Darem La Mano, the duet from Mozart's opera Don Giovanni. Sabina Meyer was the clarinetist, and Franz Felsenmerst conducted the Zurich Opera Orchestra. So more from the Royal Albert Hall at 10:15, a late-night prom given by the choir Ex Cathedra, conducted by Geoffrey Skidmore, a programme of Stockhausen, and that's at 10:15. Now, at 9:30, another chance to hear a programme first broadcast on BBC Radio 3 last summer in the Sunday feature. The neuroscientist and writer David Eagleman explores the invention, fantasy and flights of the imagination taken by one of Italy's foremost writers, Italo Calvino, in Suspended in Air.
He was interested in this idea of the metaphor of flight and the pursuit of knowledge through shedding baggage, heaviness, weight, and transcending it through poetry, through the liberation of language itself.
It's not an escape from reality to give a fantastic shape. It's a way to look inside ourselves and inside our problems.
Because you've freed yourself from what happens and what is, you are actually in a space of free play, and that is a place of experiment.
I thought that the real popular taste in fiction was fantasy, was not realism, was a way to speak about very real problems.
His great fear was the fact that literature was somehow limited. He often says, literature tries to represent the world. How can it when you look at it on the page and it's these black characters all nicely justified at the end on a white page? Every page is the same to look at, so how can it reflect the messiness, the unpredictability, the asymmetry of the world we live in?
In movies, the television, the papers, I think that the literature has to give something more.
Any limitation was a negative thing for literature.
Two decades after he wrote his first novel, Italo Calvino began work on a new form of storytelling, a form to which he would return throughout his working life. The cosmic comics were a series of scientific fables. They're myths spun from modern science. Cosmic comics tells the story of the history of the universe. They are interplanetary in scope. The ambition of the project tests the limits of literature. Here's the scholar and translator, Professor Martin McLaughlin.
He starts writing them about 1963, 64. He feels that realism has had its day. Realism is too limited, it's too traditional. And he looked around. What was happening in 1963, 64 was the great space race was taking place between the USA and the USSR. And he gets interested in astronomy, in the universe, in physics, and decides that really literature is lagging behind in another kind of race, and that is the race to keep up with science. And so he decides that the way to get beyond the limitations of realism is to write stories that have to do with the cosmos. And so a lot of the stories are about the moon or the sun or the planets or evolution and time. And so he invents this name, Le Cosmic Comique, the cosmic comic stories, in order not to make them too heavy. He doesn't call them the cosmic stories, no, the cosmic comic, because he feels also another way to get beyond the limitations of literature is to send it up, to make it humorous.
As a scientist and a writer of fiction myself, I've found Calvino's books to be deeply inspirational, in part for the way in which he begins with a scientific seed of an idea and grows it into its own world with its own rules. And there's always a lightness of touch, a deceptive simplicity with which he explores these complex ideas. Because the fact is that science is not antithetical with lightness and escape and fantasy and narrative and creativity. In the same way that Calvino did in Cosmic Comics, the scientist and writer Alan Lightman has frequently used scientific subject matter as a starting point for his fiction.
A lot of people, including writers, are afraid of science because of its vocabulary and the intellectual content. But what Calvino did is he would start off with just one fact in science, with evolution or with astronomy, and then spin an incredible, fantastic web out of that. For example, he knew that the moon was closer to the Earth at some times of the year than others. He knew that one fact and then erected this incredible story about collecting milk on the moon. Some people who go out to sea and get tall ladders on boats and climb up to the moon.
Then I would cling first with one hand, then with both, and immediately I would feel ladder and boat drifting away from below me, and the motion of the moon would tear me from the Earth's attraction. Yes, the moon was so strong that she pulled you up. You realized this the moment you passed from one to the other. You had to swing up abruptly with a kind of somersault, grabbing the scales, throwing your legs over your head until your feet were on the moon's surface.
He just takes one scientific fact and goes with it and spins a fable. He doesn't try to make the science logically plausible. He doesn't try to go deeply into the science. He uses the science just to spark his imagination.
Seen from the Earth, you looked as if you were hanging there with your head down, but for you, it was the normal position. And the only odd thing was that when you raised your eyes, you saw the sea above you, glistening, with the boat and the others upside down, hanging like a bunch of grapes from the vine.
Because that sort of thing that you just described is what you and I have both done in various books, which is starting with some scientific concept, some beautiful, lovely concept, and then extrapolating that to what matters for us as humans. Whether that's aging or time or death or love, whatever it is, we start with some seed, some what if, and then we just sort of crank it forward to figure out how it would matter to us. And it sounds like that's what you're describing, that Calvino did.
Yeah, I mean, what I love about Cosmic Comics is that Earth does not play a role in those stories. We're in space most of the time, and Calvino was sort of asking the question, if you do away with buildings and food and automobiles, and you do away with all of the material objects that we recognize and we base our daily life on, and you're just in outer space, what is left? So you sort of get down to the core of humanity when you do away with all material things that we know about, and you just ask, how do people relate? I'm using the word people, but they're cosmic beings. But like the Greek gods, they have anthropomorphic qualities, human qualities. How do you relate as living beings when there's no familiar material territory? And I think that's what's so brilliant about those stories, that he's going down to the essence of relationships.
That's what Calvino is doing, is bringing everything down to the barest minimum and putting the spotlight on one tiny thing and making the rest of the world disappear, but you're just looking at that minute detail.
The writer, Kate Moss. Calvino is a believer in the importance of constraints. His stories are set within ordered worlds that are made up of patterns and structures.
It's as though Calvino is imposing the rules of a game on each novel, forcing himself to play within increasingly complex designs. When Kate Moss first read The Castle of Crossed Destinies, she was struck by Calvino's desire to set such ambitious restrictions on himself.
The quite staggering ambition of deciding that you were going to write a short story, really, I suppose, where nobody spoke. So although, obviously, you are in the narrator's head and the narrator is telling you what happened, the truth is that this group of travellers, we don't know who they are, find themselves in this same place. We know that they haven't lost their hearing because they're all the sounds of the spoons and the bowls and the slurping of the wine. And there's a pack of tarot cards in the middle of the table, the Visconti tarot in the first story. And our narrator opens his mouth to speak. Everybody wants to tell their story, but they've all been struck dumb. Now, that, as a novelist, the challenge of that, putting a load of people around a table with a pack of cards and going, but guess what? Nobody can speak. So I think even before I was a writer, I had that sense of the enormous ambition of trying to pull something like that off.
I always complicate my ideas. I draw patterns, schemes, and I put to myself rules that not always I respect. In some way, I am always complicating my life. I don't know why.
People say, well, it's just about structure and shape. It's not really about an idea, not trying to change our lives. I think Calvino would never have agreed with that. One of the things he does in later life, I think, is to try and write in a way that encapsulates something, a universe, gives you, the reader, a sense of a whole world. So Invisible Cities, it's 55 cities, but they, in a sense, are cities that represent every kind of city. And so And If in a Winter's Night is a novel about 10 or 11 different novels read by the readers, but they are set in, or written by Belgian or Japanese or South American novelists. So the empirical reader of If in a Winter's Night comes away with a feeling that he or she has read every novel, or at least an example of every novel. And I think that means that since he was trying to pursue a sense of totality, I think he would never have been happy with a style of writing that was limited to just gamesmanship, or by the same token, was limited to just putting across a heavy, serious sociopolitical message. It's got to be both for Calvino.
For me, it feels very, very rooted in a much older form of storytelling. So the opposite to modern and pushing the boundaries in a funny sort of way. I mean, much more older, you know, Scheherazade.
With his love of experiment and his ability to move deftly between writing styles, it's hard to pin Calvino to a genre. But perhaps he would agree with Kate Moss's idea that fundamentally he's engaged in a much older form of storytelling.
I think that I came across him as soon as I began to be interested in thinking about fairy tales as a literary form.
The cultural historian Marina Warner.
He was the major figure in Italian fairy tale dissemination. Nobody had done what the Grimms did for German fairy tales in Italy.
My publisher asked me to make a collection of Italian folk tales, a general collection, which didn't exist. And I went through this huge forest of tales, and I chose, and I rewrote, translating from the dialects, I rewrote in the same spirit. And this was a very important work for me.
He said it was obsessive, collecting this material, just completely obsessive, and that he, you know, he lost every sense of anything being valuable apart from finding another version of one of the stories. And at one time he would have given his entire life and all of world literature to find another version of the gold dung donkey. And the gold dung donkey is the donkey whose excrement is gold. And of course, this is a comic peasant dream, a crude comic peasant dream of wealth falling out of the sky or falling out of a donkey. So this was the kind of structure that he was interested in narrative, how in a light way, in a sprightly and deft way, it can actually go to the heart of
inequalities and injustice and make fun of them, and by making fun of them, form a kind of resistance. I think Calvino was very important in actually giving folk tales and fairy tales back their importance. And that was partly because he did refuse this idea that they were just sheer escapism. And he actually says, very boldly in the introduction to Italian Folk Tales, he says, "Now that the book is finished, I know that this wasn't a hallucination, but the confirmation of something I already suspected. Folk tales are real." And I think what he means by that is that this is the kind of the sediment of people's experiences, and it's transformed into a universal language by the fantasy, whereas realism is far too wedded to particular circumstance.
The passion with which Calvino devoured folk tales and fables was symptomatic of his voracious reading habits. He had a love and engagement with a vast range of writers, and all of these influences seeped into his fiction.
He actually parted company with the idea that the 20th century writer, the modern writer, should be completely original. He's interested in, you know, what is called intertextuality, or, I mean, he responds to other writers, to existing texts, to what already is known. He likes joining the collective memory of literary forms and motifs and stories. So, you know, it's no accident that Invisible Cities is Marco Polo retold, The Castle of Crossed Destinies is medieval romances retold. He's very much at the forefront of this idea that literature is not single acts of independent originality. As a socialist sympathizer, as a believer in the literature and culture of the common people, whatever you want to call them, of the illiterate before literacy, mass literacy, he is also against the form of writing that emerged with commercial capitalism, which is the single author who becomes a kind of great, rich, single individual figure who's totally unique. I mean, in fact, this model of the writer does achieve singularity. I mean, Calvino is unique. His voice is singular. He is absolutely himself alone. You could never mistake him for any of the people with whom he's in dialogue.
You are about to begin reading Italo Calvino's new novel, If on a Winter's Night a Traveller. Relax. Concentrate. Dispel every other thought. Let the world around you fade. Best to close the door. The TV is always on in the next room. Tell the others right away, no, I don't want to watch TV. Raise your voice, they won't hear you otherwise. I'm reading, I don't want to be disturbed. Maybe they haven't heard you with all that racket. Speak louder, yell. I'm beginning to read Italo Calvino's new novel. Or if you prefer, don't say anything. Just hope they'll leave you alone. So here you are now, ready to attack the first lines of the first page. You prepare to recognise the unmistakable tone of the author.
I think that was one of his aspirations right from the start, was never to repeat himself. Always to do a book that's totally different from the one that had come out previously. And he alludes to this in the opening pages of If on a Winter's Night. Do you remember he says to the reader, OK, so you've just bought Calvino's If on a Winter's Night a Traveller. You sit down in the armchair, you open the first page, and you settle down to recognise Calvino's unmistakable accent.
No, you don't recognise it at all. But now that you think about it, whoever said this author had an unmistakable tone? On the contrary, he is known as an author who changes greatly from one book to the next. And in these very changes, you recognise him as himself. Here, however, he seems to have absolutely no connection with all the rest he has written, at least as far as you can recall. Are you disappointed?
The huge variety of what he wrote came probably, I would almost say, from a sense of fun. I think it was an enjoyment of seeing where you can take words and where you can take ideas.
Adam Pollock first met Italo Calvino in 1976. Adam was running a small opera festival in Tuscany, and that's where they had a chance encounter and became friends.
It's a lovely thing I found when I first went to Italy, where in English, people, and you're going to say, oh, I'm going to do this, and people say, why? And in Italy, it's always perché no, why not? And I think that is a very typically Italian thing, and I think that was very, very strong in Italo. And also, it emphasises the importance of not being hidebound, of going ahead into whatever new worlds there may be, for good or bad. I think he really wanted just to keep the world open.
Adam Pollock had long had a desire to stage Mozart's Zaida, which was an unfinished opera in need of a libretto. So he tentatively mentioned the idea to Calvino in the hope that he might consider it. And soon, he found himself presented with a completed manuscript.
It was written just about the time of From Winter's Night, a Traveller, so it has that feeling of a sort of journey which you don't know where the signposts are going to go next.
When Adam suggested the idea of a collaboration with Mozart, well, I thought that it was very difficult, it was almost impossible, but I never could resist a challenge.
It began in a fairly conventional way, saying these little bits of music and hard to put together and the mice have eaten bits of it and so on and so forth. And then he tells you the story until he gets to a certain point and the audience is sort of lulled into its seats, think, oh yeah, it's going along, it's very nice and very charming. And then he says, no, I don't think this is a successful story. Let's go back and see what would happen if X, instead of being in love with Y, was in love with Z. And he then gives three hypotheses. And so it's like, well, I was thinking like a juggler, really, throwing up all these various ideas. Then at the end, when you think, oh, well, it's either one of these three things, then he says, well, no, perhaps it's a fourth.
I hope I am not so far from Mozart's intentions. I tried to build a sort of a kaleidoscope. This is what I hope I've done with Zaid.
As somebody who was always looking for new ideas, always interested in new ideas, his connections with opera came from the love of experiment and fun, maybe, rather than a particular passion for music. I think that Zaida, but also the Berio opera as well, the first one certainly, they came out of an idea of, well, this is something new, this is going to be a new road.
The uniqueness of Calvino's worlds has attracted writers and composers and painters to use his work as a starting point for their own artistic adventures. The composer, Sally Beamish, based her 2003 trumpet concerto on Calvino's Invisible Cities.
The way he describes the least attractive aspects of the cities is with a kind of passion. So it is with a sort of love and passion, so that whether it's squalid or whether it's intensely beautiful, there's the same feeling of encompassing the atmosphere of each place. The novel is almost like a city landscape in that it's got these little building blocks, which make a kind of skyline almost. Well, in my imagination it does. Even the lengths of the names of the cities, they kind of make shapes in your head. And the way that they're mostly women's names as well, which is quite strange. So you have this idea of these multiple personalities of these cities that are sort of alluring and yet slightly sordid at the same time.
As an English language reader, I began to wonder how Calvino's imaginative, fantastical world comes across in its original language. Is there a quality contained in the Italian which the English translation loses?
Of course, they're missing out on the sound. You can't reproduce those words exactly in English, obviously. And so you're missing some of the music, some of the melody, if you like, to use a kind of operatic metaphor. We're only reading the subtitles, as it were. And so there's some loss of power there, loss of reception, I think. The central city in Invisible Cities is a city which in Italian is called Bauchi. And all the cities are described in little a page or two of kind of poetic prose. And there's a lovely little piece of film with Calvino reading that central city, which is a city where all the inhabitants have fled the earth and gone up into the sky, and they live on a sort of city made of stilts. And he says nobody knows why they've gone there. Maybe they respect the earth too much, or maybe they hate it, or maybe they just feel their own presence would clutter it, and so they stare at the earth from these clouds and stilts through telescopes, and he gets into description.
Tre ipotesi si danno sugli abitanti di Bauchi, che odino la terra, che la rispettino al punto di evitare ogni contatto, che la amino come era prima di loro e con cannocchiali e telescopi puntati in giù, non si stanchino di passarla in rassegna, foglia a foglia.
Blade of grass by blade of grass.
Sasso a sasso.
Stone by stone.
Formica per formica.
Ant by ant. And then he ends in Italian, contemplando affascinati la propria assenza.
La propria assenza.
Contemplating with fascination their own absence. And I think, you know, the English doesn't quite get the beautiful smoothness of that piece of very carefully worked poetic prose.
I was very conscious of these images being elusive and that you couldn't quite put your finger on them and that they were slipping away all the time and unstable, so that the structures were solid in themselves, but they were sort of suspended. And I wanted to create that feeling in the music, that it was almost floating. It wasn't anchored in anything. It was almost that if you touched it, it would disappear. Certainly, writing music is always, to me, is a little bit like being an architect, that you have to design the shape of the thing so that it stands up. And in a way, with this piece, I was taking away its foundations so that it sort of floated.
Composer Sally Beamish. In 1984, Calvino began to assemble a manifesto of sorts, an exploration of his literary ideals. He'd been asked to deliver the Charles Eliot Norton lectures at Harvard. In the first of these, Calvino explained that after 40 years of writing fiction, it was finally time for him to search for an overall definition of his work. He offered a suggestion that, as he put it, more often than not, his writing involved the subtraction of weight from people, heavenly bodies, sometimes from cities, but above all from the structure of stories and from language. This key quality was lightness.
Leggerezza, which he takes figuratively and literally. So figuratively, he is interested in the imagination of ascension, the imagination of flight, which goes, you know, way back to the beginning of literature and myth, and has connotations almost always either with bliss in the ascension or with terror in the descent, the plunge. So he's interested in the turning point where lightness, you know, becomes weight and you begin to fall and all the reverberations of that.
You fasten your seatbelt. The plane is landing. To fly is the opposite of travelling. You cross a gap in space, you vanish into the void. You accept not being in any place for a duration that is itself a kind of void in time. Then you reappear in a place and in a moment with no relation to the where and the when in which you vanished. Meanwhile, what do you do? How do you occupy this absence of yourself from the world and of the world from you? you read. You do not raise your eyes from the book between one airport and the other, because beyond the page there is the void. You might as well stick with this other abstraction of travel, accomplished by the anonymous uniformity of typographical characters. Here, too, is the evocative power of the names that persuades you that you are flying over something and not nothingness.
For Calvino, flight doesn't represent an escape from reality. Instead, it's a different angle from which to engage reality.
He likens it in, I think, a very suggestive and rather early passage in which the writer invokes shamanism. But he invokes the shaman's flight. And he says in that paragraph that the shaman's flight is a quest for knowledge, and that he sees literature as a quest for knowledge, that it's trying to press forward the understanding. So that relates to the earlier idea about it not being perhaps the individual psyche so much as he's interested in, as the larger episteme of the community's knowledge.
In my fiction, I wanted to express the complexity, the ambiguity of our time.
He'd been brought up throughout the 20s and 30s in a very sheltered habitat.
Martin McLaughlin again.
His father was a director of the local botanical gardens. He was a great experimenter with plants. And his mother was the first woman to have a chair in botany in Italy in the 1920s. And so he lived in this hothouse atmosphere, really, surrounded by beautiful exotic plants. And then suddenly, in 1940, Italy joins on the German side in the Second World War. He is initially conscripted into the pre-military organisations of the fascist